KCH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Millions of Americans hit the roads and skies this holiday weekend. The TSA expecting to screen more than 17 million passengers. A 180, former President Trump a day earlier saying that Florida's six-week abortion ban is too short.
Trump now saying, I'll be voting no, meaning a vote in favor of keeping Florida's six-week ban in place. The Harris campaign saying, voters aren't stupid.
Why don't they trust women?
The Harris campaign announcing a new reproductive freedom bus tour across battleground states, kicking off in Trump's backyard, Palm Beach, Florida.
ABC's Jacqueline Lee. The FDA now authorizing the updated COVID vaccine from Novavax for those 12 and older. It targets the highly contagious Omicron subvariant, unlike Moderna's and Pfizer's shots, which are based on mRNA technology. The Novavax shot is based on a protein-based vaccine. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says dozens of health violations found at a Boar's Head plant in Virginia linked to listeria. This is ABC. A grim discovery in the search for a couple who went missing from a nudist colony in Southern California a week ago. A 62-year-old man arrested in the disappearance of his neighbors Stephanie and Daniel Maynard after police said human remains were found under his home. ABC's Rob McMillan at the scene.
Police finding the suspect, Michael Sparks, hiding out beneath his home. Tammy Wilkerson, who lives next door, says the whole situation is bizarre.
I don't know. People just don't dig tunnels under their house and behind their house.
She says she actually drove Sparks several times to Home Depot to buy the concrete.
I couldn't imagine why somebody would buy bags and bags of cement.
Wilkerson says she was aware of tension between Sparks and the Menards.
And you never know what you might have stashed away in your home. A 17th century Rembrandt painting randomly found in the attic of a Camden, Maine home selling at auction for $1.4 million. Dave Packer, ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
Out here in the middle of all these acres, it can feel like you're the only person on earth. And sometimes that's how it feels when you're going through tough times. Trouble sleeping, your mind racing. So what do? We get help. There are people in our community who are here for us. Sometimes just talking to someone can make all the difference in the world. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
It's summertime in Wisconsin, and whatever the weather, it will impact you and your plans.
Should I water the garden? Will our event be rained out? Count on your local Civic Media radio station for in-depth details and the most up-to-date forecast.
Temperatures are rising into the mid and upper 70s under sunny skies.
It's your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app.
I'm Terry Bell. The site of the former General Motors plant in Janesville has been empty for 15 years. The city is applying for a federal grant to spur new and more sustainable development there. Here's Mike Moan.
The city of Janesville will host a trio of public listening sessions in September as it prepares to apply for a $20 million EPA grant that focuses on environmental justice. The city's economic development director, Jim Z. Cuborn, says as they try to reimagine the old General Motors and JATCO site, they want surrounding neighborhoods experiencing low incomes and other side effects to have a brighter future.
We've got trees growing up in the middle of the asphalt and fences falling over, and so go in and create a green opportunity, a green field for new development and new opportunity.
She says that could include new energy-efficient housing and the possibility of solar projects. The GM site was demolished just prior to the pandemic, and this specific EPA grant doesn't deal with needed soil cleanup work. But Cuborn touts the importance of pursuing environmentally friendly development so that neighborhoods don't have to deal with things such as excessive stormwater runoff from these old sites. Cuborn says cities like Janesville aren't alone in confronting this problem.
There are multiple sites throughout the United States where we've seen things offshored, some things reshore, and communities are sitting on these blighted assets.
Janesville has encountered roadblocks, including working with a private company and getting the GM site fully free of contamination and its remaining concrete removed. And a recent Brookings Institution report outlined how the area has been able to survive without solely relying on heavy manufacturing. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Beck.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunny today with a high near 80 degrees. It will be breezy out of the southwest. Tonight, a few scattered storms and a low around 48. For Sunday, sunshine, a little breezy still with a high near 68. Sunny Labor Day with a high of 72, 73 Tuesday.
Right now, it's 62.
Maggie Dawn.
Next up for Maggie and the Millionaires, we'll be talking with Saru Jayaraman. We'll also check in with Dr. Ben Weston, medical advisor to Milwaukee County, and Chef Adam Pavla.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and this is the second hour of our weekend-venued weekly review of all things government and rule of law, justice-related, lots of things having to do with the courts this week. And in particular, lots of things being filed, being written, authored by lawyers, writing to judges about what should happen in these various cases. We've already reviewed what's going to be happening this coming week in front of the judge, Tanya Chutkan, as she tries to figure out what happens next in that major federal election interference case, now the subject of a new superseding indictment in front of her, bringing all the parties in to talk with her this coming week, this Thursday, about what they think she should do next. We've got three other cases out there, all criminal in nature, federal and state courts as well, and other things filed just this past week by the attorneys in those cases as well. Let's talk about the New York so-called hush money case. This is the one in which Donald Trump is now a convicted felon and in which the presumption of innocence no longer applies. He has been convicted of violations of New York state law, false statements, fraudulent representations in monies given to at least one person. Some evidence of others as well to prevent the disclosure into the public domain of information about an affair that he had. Yes, that's right. This is the Stormy Daniels case. And in particular, the jury there finding unanimously 34 counts of violations of federal law. The judge, his name is Juan Merchan, scheduling in past weeks two hearings coming up, not this week, but the following week. September 16th and 18th, well in advance of the November election, September 16th and 18th, a Monday, and also then a Wednesday of the same week, two hearings he has got scheduled. What's the reason for those hearings? Well, number one, he is presumably going to be announcing on September 16th, just a couple of weeks from now, his decision on whether or not that Supreme Court immunity decision mandates that he somehow reverse the decision of the jury in that New York case. Does he have to do anything in the wake of that immunity decision that would affect the judgment of the jury? The answer, almost certainly no, but he has entertained motions and memorandums and writings previously, and he will be presumably announcing his decision on that issue on September 16th. It's a threshold issue once again, because obviously if he finds, which he almost certainly will not, but if he finds that somehow that immunity decision, that federal immunity decision, applies to the focus, the facts of the case in front of him, having to do with an election, a campaign of a private individual way back in 2016, if he should find that somehow that case has got to be reversed, the judgment's got to be returned, and we've got to have a new trial there, then he doesn't proceed to sentencing. But much more likely on September 16th, Judge Juan Merchan, having considered the filings and the arguments of the parties in both directions in that case, going to be announcing decision that the case should proceed. And if it does then, and presumably it will, then on September 18th, something will happen in America that has never happened before in our nation's history, and that is that a former president of the United States of America will be sentenced for crimes that he committed, admittedly before he was a president, but nonetheless, crimes that he committed. And Judge Mershonis indicated that on September 18th, that is the date in which he will impose sentence upon Donald Trump. He has already postponed that date to give the parties an opportunity to be heard on this immunity decision. But significant dates coming up here in the month of September. Tanya Chutkan again, September 5th on her hearing. September 16th and 18th in front of Juan Merchan. What happened just this past week that could, again, with a very small c, affect those dates in front of Judge Juan Merchan? Well, once again, Donald Trump's attorneys have filed a motion that they filed before in federal court, in which they were unsuccessful previously. The request is just this. It is to remove, it's to take that state case pending in front of Juan Merchan in the Manhattan court and move it off to federal court, basically across the plaza, if you will, there in the plaza there in Manhattan, and move the entire case into federal court, presumably where Donald Trump would move to dismiss the case there. Now, that issue has already been decided previously by federal judges who have said dispositively there's nothing about this New York case, the allegations against Donald Trump that partakes of a federal violation that would warrant the particular case being tried in a federal court. Certainly other things might be the subject of federal proceedings. Witness the Tanya Chutkan proceeding, the superseding indictment, but not here. And so the case has already been resolved. This issue has been addressed by a federal judge, renewed this past week, once again seeking yet another opportunity to argue this case. And in the very remote chance that somehow a federal judge should say, yes, indeed, it should be brought into federal court, that could upset that schedule. Prediction with great certainty that will not happen. The federal judges will not revisit and reverse their previous decision. In fact, the case will stay there. But Donald Trump's attorneys in that case just this past week, in their pleading in that Manhattan case, filing this motion to have the entire case removed to the federal court, nonetheless, highly likely that in mid-September, Judge Juan Merchan will bring it to resolution and impose a sentence in mid-September, giving Donald Trump then a pathway to appeal that decision, the sentencing, and everything that preceding it, all the things related to the trial, evidentiary matters in anticipation of the trial, pretrial matters, all of those things can then be appealed to the New York State Appeals Court. And he can do that, and that will certainly proceed. Likewise, after that, he can petition to the New York Supreme Court, arguably, although again, not without great dispute, could also seek some certiorari review before the Supreme Court of the United States. Not a lot of indication that the Supreme Court would rule favorably on a state case. They shouldn't be doing that, but we don't know what the Supreme Court may do. All of that, however, to indicate uncertainty about the future, aside from these cases proceeding in front of Judge Juan Merchan very, very soon. None of this going to be resolved dispositively anytime in 2024. Arguably in 2025, more likely in 2026, lots more appellate proceedings to be pursued by Donald Trump. Again, that's his right in our system, and he will do that as this case, at least in the trial court, in front of Judge Juan Merchan, concludes in just a couple of weeks. A couple of other things going on in other cases also pending around our nation. Let's talk about Mar-a-Lago. That's the documents case also being prosecuted by Jack Smith. Again, he is a federal attorney being brought by the Department of Justice. There's a grand jury indictment there that was the subject of review by Judge Eileen Cannon. She, in the end, without addressing the merits of that, there's been no trial there on the merits of that. She determined again a number of weeks ago, as you all well know, that case needed to be dismissed. Why? Because she found, contrary to precedent, contrary to all of the established standards of judicial review on this issue, that Jack Smith did not have the proper authority to prosecute the case, that the attorney general, in appointing him, did it without constitutional basis, without statutory basis, that only the president can do this upon advice and consent of the Senate, or there had to be some other statutory explicit grant of authority to do this. Of course, that's ridiculous. And it is a position that, while also articulated by a sitting member of our Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas, also said that in connection with his concurrence in a recent opinion. None of this is a focus of appropriate judicial consideration. Nonetheless, she found, contrary to years and years of practice and years of statement by other judges, including the Supreme Court, that this case needed to be dismissed. It is now up at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And that is where, just this past week, Jack Smith, again, writing a lot of things this past week, Jack Smith, just this past week, submitting his motion, his memorandum, his document, if you will, to the 11th Circuit, and indicating in that sense, in that pleading, that the court there should reinstate the classified documents case against former President Donald Trump, saying along the way the judge's decision, Eileen Cannon's ruling, that dismissed that prosecution was completely at odds with longstanding Justice Department practice and has to be reversed, he says. He said that District Judge Eileen Cannon made a grievous mistake by ruling that Smith was unlawfully appointed by Attorney General Merrick Garland. He said that position runs counter to rulings by judges across the country. Again, this is the specific language of what he wrote this past week to the appeals court, as well as widespread and longstanding appointment practices in the Department of Justice and across the government. Went on to say in this pleading to the 11th Circuit, if allowed to stand, it could jeopardize the longstanding operation of the Justice Department and call into question hundreds of appointments throughout the executive branch. Went on to say, the Attorney General validly appointed the special counsel, who is also properly funded. There was also this allegation that through the appropriations process, the position was not appropriately pursued and supported financially by the United States Congress. In ruling otherwise, Jack Smith says, the district court deviated from binding Supreme Court precedent, misconstrued the statutes that authorize a special counsel's appointment, and took inadequate account of the longstanding history of the Attorney General appointments of special counsels. Indeed, prosecutors said that no fewer than four statutes give the Attorney General expressly this power to appoint a special counsel like Smith. And for that reason, all of this needs to be returned to the district court for action and presumably the scheduling of a trial coming up. That is what Jack Smith submitted to the 11th Circuit just this past week. Now the defense, of course, is a part of our system, the appellate system as well, also has the opportunity in the coming weeks to respond to that, to present its own position, plainly in support of what Eileen Cannon has done. They will then submit their brief in opposition to what Jack Smith has said just this past week in his pleadings. And presumably, at some point, the 11th Circuit will have oral argument on all of this. Oral argument presumably before a three-judge panel to question the attorneys about the merits of their positions set forth in these pleadings. All of that coming up before the 11th Circuit. All of that once again affirming that there is simply no way that any of this will see the light of day in terms of a trial anytime soon, perhaps into 2025, perhaps even beyond that, depending upon how far this goes. Remember, none of this went to trial. All sorts of pretrial matters, including national security matters, also have to be addressed by the judge in that case. Interesting to see what will happen if indeed the 11th Circuit, as it should, sends this back down for further review. Who gets to review the case? What judge will be there? We'll talk more about that and other things here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. I want to talk today to the folks who are trying to decide between funding their retirement or funding their kids' future education. Because for a lot of us, this is an either-or choice. And I'm here to tell you, or just to give you permission, to fund your retirement before a 529 or another school-specific savings plan. Why? Well, your kids can borrow money for their education, and they might get scholarships or grants to help them pay for it. But there aren't loans to help you pay for retirement. And while Social Security will be there to support you, most of us want or need to live on a little more than what Social Security provides. And if you don't save for retirement, your kids could ultimately end up on the hook paying for your care. Taking care of you is also taking care of them. For more everyday money tips, check out Work Money Media on YouTube. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this, the second hour of our broadcast here on the stations of Civic Media, talking about what the lawyers are doing this past week. Lots and lots of writing, lots and lots of filings in the courts, both state and federal courts across our nation, including in the election interference case in Washington, D.C., that case in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan, a renewed motion in front of Judge Juan Merchan in Manhattan. Then also this Mar-a-Lago case, the special counsel there filing his appellate brief in the 11th Circuit, arguing that the lower court's decision should be reversed and sending that case back to presumably Eileen Cannon. Interesting to see if the 11th Circuit, when it will send this case back, presumably almost assuredly finding that what she has done is not lawful, not legal, and should be reversed. Will they also send this back with directions to have sign this case to somebody new? Will Jack Smith ask that that be done as a part of the court's what's called the remand of this case back to the lower court? Or will Eileen Cannon once again be responsible for going ahead now, as she has done sort of before all of this happened? Recall well that the 11th Circuit previously, in connection with that civil attack upon the criminal investigation, she was agreeing with and embracing much of what the defense said. 11th Circuit basically said, Eileen Cannon, you're completely wrong about that, reversed her and sent that back to her previously. We'll see what the 11th Circuit does. Again, almost certainly, once again, reversing her. Question about whether or not, in the wake of all of that, should Eileen Cannon continue to preside over this matter, or should there be a new judge who does not exhibit the kind of bias and prejudice, if you will, to the government's case that she plainly has? Defense has a right to a not a perfect trial, but a fair trial. Government also has that same right, not to a perfect trial, but to a fair trial in front of an impartial judge. Both sides have got just that right. We'll see what the 11th Circuit does in all of those cases. As always, we appreciate callers and folks who are in touch with us here on our weekend broadcast. We appreciate Sherry sending us a note here in support of what we're doing here in this broadcast. Also appreciate callers who are coming in and being a part of our discussion. Appreciate especially this weekend. Calling in from San Francisco is David. David, appreciate very much your question, your comment, your inquiry about the subject matter of our broadcast.
Hey, well, appreciate it. It's funny. You were talking about Judge Cannon there, and the word crossed my mind that instead of her intransigence, whether it's more of a cowardice, that she doesn't want to go against the one that brought her in, since Trump appointed her. And if I remember right, Judge Cannon, after Trump lost the 2020 election, in the brief days, what was it, about a month between Inauguration Day and Election Day, Trump appointed her in that interim, and the Senate approved. And so she was a magical appearance. If I remember right, Obama was kept from appointing over 200 judges. The Senate just refused to authorize a single one of Obama's appointments. So he went for 2 years without having a single judge get appointed. And so all of a sudden, Trump gets to appoint those 200. And the Senate fast-tracked them all, and many of them are crooked as hell. They, the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society, I'm for yanking their corporate charters. I'm for yanking their nonprofit status. They are not making a more perfect union. They're making a corporate state. And these judges are, you know, the idea that they can, that in public conveyances, that public safety is not seen as a necessity. So the idea that all of a sudden the state of Missouri can start a lawsuit about wearing a mask on a public conveyance across international boundaries.
Right. David, you know, lots of good thoughts there about our judiciary. Let me just pluck out one of them. And again, thank you for your comments here. You know, this notion about not only appointments is sometimes very, very relevant. We often note now who is appointed judges. It is a source of some disappointment, is it not, for you, for me, for all of us, that we always identify judges now according to who has appointed them, because judges, of course, should be impartial, right? And your point is that they're not. And whether we look to the Supreme Court, we look to Eileen Cannon, we certainly seem to have a judge there appointed by Donald Trump. Your initial point that perhaps she is animated by concern about presiding over a trial of a person who's sitting there at the defense table, who appointed her to the very bench that she is now sitting on. That's a concern. Even more importantly, I think implicit, if not explicit in your comment, David, is this notion that our judges and our justices, who are sworn to be impartial, it should not be a product of who appoints them, whether it's Obama or Trump, other people, Joe Biden. It should not be a product of their appointed president, if you will, the president who was appointing them. They should bring to all of these positions, especially those judges who have lifetime tenure, as Eileen Cannon does, as the other justices on the Supreme Court do as well, a focus on justice and doing what's right. And if that doesn't happen, that's the concern that you're articulating. Again, the concern that comes out of Eileen Cannon in particular is beyond that. She's got this track record of showing great animus and great bias toward the prosecution itself in shutting down the investigation preliminarily. And again, being overturned by the 11th Circuit, now shutting down this criminal prosecution itself under circumstances that are completely unprecedented. And for that reason, I think your observation about her bias and the concerns about her continuing to handle this case, very well stated. David, appreciate your calling in from San Francisco and being a part of our broadcast this weekend. We also have Dick calling in from Madison. Dick, thanks so much for your inquiry or your comment as well here on Amicus.
Well, to Trump with this situation of appealing again, you know, the average person like me would never be able to pull this off because he's flushed out. But what's sickening about it, he's using all his campaign money for his legal bills. There ought to be a way of at least stopping that. I mean, I guess I understand if you're such a sycophant that you're going to give to this guy knowing that he's going to siphon it off. But And the other thing is, if he wants to try and get all of this to this criminal Supreme Court we have right now, if he were to get reelected, what's the difference between when he said in his own words, well, if you plead the fifth, you're guilty. Well, if you stand behind immunity, aren't you saying, what are you immune to? You've done something wrong, correct? Guilty.
Right. Very, very good thoughts here, Dick. Again, lots of inconsistencies there in Donald Trump's public statements and the things he has said in court, and certainly that his attorneys have said as well. This issue generally about payments, all these attorneys plainly are private attorneys. They have the absolute important role in this process, also getting paid, right? And they have to be paid, should be paid. And the question is, again, where does that money come from? If it's coming from sources that are meant for campaign purposes, problems there both in terms of the law and also about what the contributions are being made for. Lots and lots of good comments there about this process, the importance of lawyers, but also the importance of being an honest broker before the courts. When we continue more of this discussion, and we'll talk in particular about what's happening in Georgia, yet another case in which the lawyers are filing documents here in Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for matinee on air.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Millions of Americans hit the roads and skies this holiday weekend. The TSA expecting to screen more than 17 million passengers. A 180. Former President Trump a day earlier saying that Florida's six-week abortion ban is too short.
Trump now saying, I'll be voting no, meaning a vote in favor of keeping Florida's six-week ban in place. The Harris campaign saying, voters aren't stupid.
Why don't they trust women?
The Harris campaign announcing a new reproductive freedom bus tour across battleground states, kicking off in Trump's backyard, Palm Beach, Florida.
ABC's Jacqueline Lee. The FDA now authorizing the updated COVID vaccine from Novavax for those 12 and older. It targets the highly contagious Omicron subvariant, unlike Moderna's and Pfizer's shots, which are based on mRNA technology. The Novavax shot is based on a protein-based vaccine. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says dozens of health violations found at a Boar's Head plant in Virginia linked to listeria. This is ABC.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Packers beat the Ravens. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Packers won their final preseason game 30-7 over the Baltimore Ravens. Green Bay finishing with a preseason record of 2 wins and 1 loss. On defense, the Packers had 4 takeaways, including linebacker Christian Welch, who once played for the Ravens and is a native of Iola, Wisconsin, head coach Matt LaFleur.
He's just a smart, tough, physical player. I thought that interception that he had was an outstanding play. It looked like, to me, he baited the quarterback right there as a hook player and just made a great break on the ball and made the play. And then he had a heck of a return.
Who's going to be the Packers kicker? Greg Olsen and Anders Carlson both had field goals from beyond 50 yards out. Then Carlson missed wide right from just 32 yards out.
Both those guys went in there and hit a 54-yarder and a 55-yarder. And then there's a poor moment there where we miss a chip shot.
Baseball, Brewers and the A's tonight in Oakland. The Crew winning last night 11-3. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunny today with a high near 80 degrees. It will be breezy out of the southwest. Tonight, a few scattered storms and a low around 48. For Sunday, sunshine, a little breezy still with a high near 68. Sunny Labor Day with a high of 72, 73 Tuesday.
Currently 66 degrees.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones. Check 511WI.gov or download the app for road work or closures on your route. Know before you go with 511 Wisconsin, sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
Matt Nair on air.
You know, Greg Bach, I think it is time I need a little time away.
Jane, are you going on vacation?
Yes, I am going on vacation. I feel confident you're going to do a great job. You got Calvin.
Wait, I'm hosting?
Yes, dear, you're going to be hosting.
I thought you were taking me with you. Okay, I guess I will host the show in your stead. Thank you very much.
I trust you.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
I learned patience from my adoptive dad. All he had to say was,
hey, you got this. Just breathe. Hey. Hey, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
Might have to start a band.
I got it.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
The Todd Alba Show.
Trigvi Olsen, senior advisor to the Lincoln Project. They put out fake AI photos of
Taylor Swift saying that she endorsed him.
Right. And Trump retweeted that. And of course, all of that is untrue.
Don't mess with the Swifties. Exactly. You'll have my daughters showing up.
I mean, it's
house.
A whole new level of Swift boating.
Trump and Las Vita might get Swift boated. All right. Taylor Swift boated.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Jane, Matt, Nair, and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we sit down and talk to labor leaders from all over Wisconsin for our Labor Day celebration. Please join us and happy Labor Day.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
This is Amicus, a law review, as we continue to talk about all the things lawyers are doing this past week in the courts of America, including what's going on in the fourth case, also pending against Donald Trump, a present candidate for the presidency. This one is in Fulton County. Fulton County, at least it was there in front of Judge Scott McAfee. You may recall well that Scott McAfee, in addressing a motion that was brought by the defense, including the defendant ultimately, Donald Trump and others in that case, seeking to have Fonnie Willis, the prosecutor, the DA there in Fulton County, removed on the basis that her behavior with respect to a co-counsel, her special prosecutor, a fellow named Nathan Wade, her personal relationship with him was a conflict of interest somehow, and that for that reason she should be removed. Scott McAfee, looking at all that, having a hearing, again, getting documents from the lawyers, decides in the end it's not a conflict of interest, but said it does present an appearance of impropriety. And so as a result of that, Nathan Wade removes himself. He goes off the case and the case proceeds. But in the wake of that decision, not removing Fonnie Willis or her office from that prosecution in Georgia, that is the state prosecution against Donald Trump and many others for election interference there, that goes up to the appeals court there in Georgia, and that's where it's pending right now. And that's where, just this past week, attorneys are once again filing papers. And this time, it's Donald Trump's attorneys who have filed their memorandum in support of reversing Judge Scott McAfee's decision and directing that he, when the case goes back down, find that Fonnie Willis should not be on the case, basically reversing what he has done. That's what they're asking the appeals court there, the state appeals court, coming out of Fulton County to do. Well, what did they file just this past week? Among other things, again, alleging that Fonnie Willis, during the course of their extra courtroom events and appearances in the area, accusing her of repeated public displays of racial animus toward the former president, Donald Trump, the defendant there, and his co-defendants. And they maintain that that racial animus, their allegations against her, have jeopardized Donald Trump's right to a fair trial. That's what they're arguing now to the appellate division, the appellate court there. They indicated that based upon that, the appeals court should disqualify Willis in her office from the case, dismiss the charges against Donald Trump. They accused the prosecutor of intentional injection of false allegations of racism into the proceedings that have tainted the case. Again, all that according to the defense that is pushing back on the position articulated by the prosecution, again, in the appellate court, that there's no reason why Fonnie Willis should be taken off the case. Now, Willis, during the course of some of her extrajudicial statements, and they were commented upon by the presiding judge, Scott McAfee, did in fact talk about some things that plainly had relationship to the trial itself. So, for example, in his March ruling, Scott McAfee called Willis's speech in the public domain legally improper, but also said it was unclear whether her remarks had met a legal standard for forensic misconduct by a prosecutor, invoking a lot of the standards there in Georgia for removal of a prosecutor. Willis did not refer to Trump or any of the co-defendants by name in this speech that she gave in January of this year in the public domain. And prosecutors have argued that she was responding to her political critics and not commenting about the trial itself. But Donald Trump's attorneys have called that claim disingenuous, and they've instead accused Willis, both as this matter has proceeded in trial, to trial, but also at the appellate level, they accused Willis of using that speech and other public remarks to falsely depict Donald Trump and his co-defendants and their attorneys as racist. And so they've said in their pleading just this past week to the appeal in the appellate court, they said this: Willis has falsely declared that allegations against her stemmed from racism to hide the fact that they were true. She went on, they wanted to say, Willis obviously intended that every potential Fulton County juror who heard or read Willis's racist speech should label the defendants as racist. Lots and lots of allegations there. And again, this is a part of the claim made by the defense in the appeal of the decision about whether or not Fonnie Willis should continue to be on the case. The filing, again, that happens early this past week, in response, interestingly, to an August 6 prosecution brief. This is when the prosecution itself filed a motion, filed its memorandum before the appellate court that called attention to a footnote in Judge McAfee's ruling. Following all this, it's getting a little bit deep, I recognize, questioning whether Trump and some of his co-defendants had standing, whether they had suffered damages in all of this. And at the time that this speech was given by Fani Willis, only co-defendant Mike Roman, may recall him among many defendants there, he was the first to level charges against misconduct against Willis. He had filed to disqualify her at that time. What happened is that on Monday, Donald Trump's attorneys, again in this appellate submission, argue that their client has standing in the wake of this footnote to challenge the speech because he was injured by Willis's remarks invoking racism, in part, as they said, because national and local media outlets broadcast and reported Willis's claim as an attack against the defense, although the brief does not cite any specific examples of that reporting. Now, all of that, there's a lot going on there, obviously. The upshot of all of this is that in the appeal now pending before the appellate court coming out of Fulton County, issues of racism in arguably both directions now being bandied about inside that. The appellate court, again, here's a date that you can write again on your calendar. The appellate court there has said that's going to hear oral argument on all of this, including the latest racism charges, including on whether the merits of the case, the decision made by Scott McAfee, should be supported or reversed. All of that's going to happen in oral argument in the appellate court there in Georgia on December 5th, many, many weeks from now, a couple months from now, after the election. 1 month after Election Day itself. And of course, that's the time once again when both Willis and Trump will be on the Fulton County ballot. Again, all of this, the intersection between politics and elective politics, and also at a time when this case is proceeding before the appellate court and presumably at some point, again, back before the trial court as well. A three-judge panel on December 5th is going to be selected to hear the case. And they're going to be hearing the merits and demerits of this particular appeal. And they're going to be entertaining argument from both sides. That's a part of our process as well about what should happen here. And again, you recall well that Donald Trump and many of his allies there charged as illegal conspiring to try to overturn the 2020 election. Parallel to the federal charges in that superseding indictment. But this coming out of the grand jury in there in Fulton County, state violations as opposed to federal violations that are pending in Washington, D.C. These pending in Georgia, in Fulton County, right now the subject of review by an appellate court there. Lots and lots of things going on in the courts of America in the wake, in the immediate aftermath of lots of submissions made by lawyers writing about what should happen. We'll continue to monitor all that and report, presumably next week and the weeks beyond, about what happens with all of those pleadings in the trial courts, the appellate courts of our land. Supreme Court has also been busy, as we know, in recent weeks, even after it's the formal sort of conclusion of the major decisions it has rendered. We talked a lot about those 58, 59 cases it has resolved, including the Fisher case, including the immunity case. Indeed, even in this period of time, as we reported last week, the Supreme Court continues to engage in decision-making in connection with its emergency docket, sometimes called the shadow docket. Why? Because in these cases, applications made by litigants to the Supreme Court asking for emergency results, and for that reason, the cases are not subject to the deliberation. The parties do not have the lengthy opportunities to submit lengthy briefs. Oral argument is traditionally not conducted, the notion being that because we've got to resolve these cases quickly, we do not have time to do all those things that we would otherwise do during the regular course of that. And we recall well that just last week we talked about this emergency decision rendered by the Supreme Court that basically upheld the decision coming out of Arizona that people newly registering there have to provide proof of citizenship, supporting part of the legislation passed by the Arizona legislature affecting the voting there. Just this past week, more decision-making coming out of our Supreme Court, our federal Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, again, on its emergency docket, maintaining a temporary pause, a temporary stop
an injunction on a new effort, by President Biden, by the executive branch, to basically wipe out tens and perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars of student debt. You may recall well that in the past, the Biden administration has proposed to eliminate, cancel more than $400 billion in loans. And in the wake of the Supreme Court rejecting that very ambitious proposal, again, as a part of its regular docket, the president came back and pursued a more limited measure. And it was directed at certain types of borrowers, including people on disability and public service workers. And he sort of refined some existing programs as well. That new plan, called the SAVE program, it's an acronym for this saving on valuable education, that's the new program that he proposed, was just this past week the subject of an emergency review and decision by the Supreme Court. And it basically supported an Eighth Circuit opinion that suspended that plan from going forward. The justice's order just this past week focused indeed upon this lawsuit that has reached the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, that's in St. Louis. In mid-July, that appeals court had issued a broad hold on this new program, the SAVE program. It was granting a request by a group of states to pause that plan while the courts consider the merits of it. The Eighth Circuit said, you've got to stop, can't go ahead with that plan. Executive branch can't do that, Joe Biden. And just this past week, on an emergency appeal, an emergency application by the Department of Justice, the Supreme Court decided to keep that block in that revamped student loan debt plan in place to basically support the Eighth Circuit saying, no, do not go ahead with this. Cannot proceed with this new SAVE program. Important result. Not dispositive. Again, in the end, presumably, the trial court, the appeals court will address the merits of this. It may well come back up to the Supreme Court. But just this past week, once again, invoking its emergency powers in this shadow docket without a clear statement of reasons why. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court stopping that plan. The plan would reduce required payments for undergraduates to 5%. The previous plan was establishing a 10% discretionary income basis. It also had to do something with the poverty line and the cancellation of debt. All that very complicated under the new plan, but addressing the kinds of concerns that the Supreme Court had identified previously. Now that plan, the latest plan, stopped by the Eighth Circuit and further stopped just this past week by the United States Supreme Court in its emergency docket, telling the Department of Education it cannot go ahead with this plan that would have canceled quite literally billions of dollars in loans, an important resolution, at least for now, of that case, especially as the new academic year continues. An awful lot of indication that about $156 billion over 10 years would have been saved and canceled by the plan. That obviously the focus of a lot of controversy, both in court and out of court, about what is happening in that case. Let's go back to Washington, D.C. as we think again about January 6th, which is the focus undeniably of Judge Tanya Chutkan's hearing of this coming Thursday. But there's more going on, of course, in Washington, D.C., and that has to do with decisions related to the continuing defendants there in Washington, D.C. Let's talk about one of them, and his name is a fellow named Justin Lee. He was one of the many defendants charged on the January 6th assault upon the Capitol. And just this past week, in a courtroom that is led by District Judge Trevor McFadden, we've talked about him from time to time before, Judge Trevor McFadden finding Justin Lee guilty of two felony offenses, assaulting, resisting, or impeding certain officers, and civil disorder, and misdemeanor offenses of entering and remaining in a restricted building or grounds, all of that coming out of that court just this past week. As we continue, we'll talk more about why this case is significant among the many January 6th prosecutions here on Amicus, a Law Review.
Listening to the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. 2 hours ago, Kyle arrived at the bar.
Hey, what's everyone drinking?
30 minutes ago, Kyle got his friends another round of drinks.
Cheers!
5 minutes ago, Kyle decided to drive home drunk. A minute ago, a law enforcement officer pulled up behind Kyle.
Sir, have you been drinking tonight?
A chain of events that began 2 hours ago is about to change Kyle's whole world. Drive sober or get pulled over.
Paid for by Wisconsin DOT.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Pickleball. Yeah. Where's Greg Baca on this? Because I'm about to offend all these many, many people in Wisconsin who play it. It's overgrown ping pong. I mean, come on.
It's underbaked tennis.
Well, I've already done it because on the text line, Matt from Germantown, don't make fun of pickleball.
We're not making fun of pickleball. We're simply making fun of the people who play pickleball. There is a difference.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning, 6 until 8. On your local civic media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
This is Amicus, the Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and this is the last segment of our weekend broadcast, talking once again about January 6th. And among the quite literally hundreds of defendants prosecuted by the Department of Justice, including the U.S. Attorney's Office there in the District of Columbia. Just this past week, an individual, Justin Lee, is 25 years old. He's from Rockville, Maryland, and it's significant because he is a Maryland police officer. Convicted just this past week, late this past week, for acts he committed during the January 6th insurrection, and he is now facing sentencing in front of the federal judge, his name, Trevor McFadden. That'll happen in November of this year. On the day of the Capitol riot, Officer Lee, identified by law enforcement authorities via some open source video, was present among a crowd of rioters who were massed at the exterior archway leading to the lower west terrace exterior door of the Capitol. If you visited there, you may have seen that particular entrance. It's also been depicted a lot in some of the photography coming out of January 6th, also indicating that the defendant here, Justin Lee, identified as standing on the steps leading to the tunnel, committing multiple acts directed at a line of officers, including throwing a smoking and sparking object in the direction of those officers. The officer himself, Justin Lee, again found guilty, now being sentenced in November for this violative conduct, violation of federal law. He has been suspended without pay by the Maryland police authorities, and the department's also pursuing the firing of him. He is one of many, many defendants, as I indicated, who continues to be prosecuted, convicted for that conduct. Important to send those messages about the deterrent impact. Why? Because if there is a message out there that somehow the people, quite literally hundreds, in this case, well in excess now of 1,000 people prosecuted for their illegal behavior, if you engage in this conduct again in any setting, whether it is in connection with the upcoming election, after the election, the result will be prosecution of this sort. And whether you are an officer of the Maryland Police Department or a private citizen, as all of those defendants will tell you, you will find yourself on the receiving end of indictments, prosecutions, and in the great majority of them, convictions and sentences. We also know that in the wake of the Supreme Court decision in this Fisher case, to which I've made repeated reference in this weekend broadcast, that's the decision issued by the Supreme Court in which they said, if you prosecute any of these many, many defendants for violations under this particular statute, talks about impeding official proceedings, you've got to establish that the defendant did something with documents and papers and material things. And the 6-3 ruling back in the spring of this past year, actually, triggered all sorts of new legal battles over how to move forward with cases that were charged under that statute beyond just Mr. Fisher's case. And so we know that the Department of Justice is looking at a number of these cases. About 259 Capitol riot defendants were charged with obstructing the congressional proceedings at the time of the Supreme Court ruling. And that's among about 1,500 cases altogether. Let me highlight just a few of those because they're significant. Prosecutors are arguing now that a husband and wife team, Donald and Shondell Chilcote,
were aware of the congressional proceeding involving records. And so while they were charged with Section 1512, they specifically understood that the electoral votes that Congress was considering would bring them within the purview, the ambit of the statute. And so, for example, in that particular case involving the Chillcotes, the government maintaining that there's nothing about the Fisher decision that prevents the prosecution of them going forward. Similarly, there's a case involving Christopher Carnell and David Bauman, and they were also found guilty of obstruction under the statute. They argued that they could justify, the government argued in justifying obstruction charges by pointing out that these two defendants on the Senate floor at the time, both of them photographed, seen, involved with letters signed by Senator Mitt Romney. Again, documents, specific things having to do with statutes. This particular statute here that requires that papers be involved in some way in order to justify the prosecution. The government now going back in the wake of that Fisher decision and analyzing all of these cases and finding that there are indeed bases for pursuing these prosecutions, even in the wake of the decision that may have granted Mr. Fisher himself some leeway in his own prosecution, still applying those in other cases. And as we said in our first hour this weekend, also Jack Smith saying 1512 and the interpretation given it by the Supreme Court, nothing about that prevents the prosecution of Donald Trump under 1512. Why? Because he, too, involved with documents and papers and materials. Those, of course, the electoral count, ballots around the country, and the voting process generally that involves papers. All of those theories, again, more than just theories, good arguments being made about the continuing vitality of these prosecutions in the wake of January 6th as to these many hundreds of defendants, including Donald Trump himself. A few other things having to do with the upcoming votes here in America, including, of course, the Wisconsin ballot itself. What's going to be happening in November here? We know that just this past week, as a part of its decision, the Wisconsin Election Commission affirmatively decided that a number of candidates should remain on the ballot in November, and they include Jill Stein, and they include others on the ballot. For example, Cornell West, the Justice for All Party, and they also include, of course, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. All of those decisions being made by our Wisconsin Election Commission, defining what our Wisconsin ballot is going to be looking like. Now, RFK Jr. himself has plainly withdrawn from the campaign for the presidency, and he has thrown his support to Donald Trump. Nonetheless, the commissioner's finding by a vote of 5-1 just this past week that his name will remain on the ballot, as will the ballots, the names of many others, including Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, Jill Stein, as he indicated, Cornell West, Robert Kennedy, others on the ballot as well. People like Claudia De La Cruz, she's a part of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. People like Randall Terry, the Constitution Party, Chase Russell Oliver on the Libertarian Party, all of those people going to be appearing on the ballot of this year in the state of Wisconsin on November 5th, all as a result of decisions made by the Wisconsin Election Commission just this past week, defining, again, the names that you will see on the ballot. Obviously, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump representing the Democratic and Republican parties principally. But important to note that there are other major parties and independent candidates whose name will also appear as a part of the process. We'll talk about more of that when we consider in the future broadcasts things related to justice in America here on Amicus, a Law Review. Thank you for joining me. Have a good weekend, everybody. Take care.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I'm in my new time slot from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. and we'll be doing my show from Madison, where joining me in studio will be award-winning filmmaker and record producer Wendy Schneider.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba,
weeknights from 6 till 8.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local candidates, as well as paid ads from issue and PAC groups. Truth is rarely as simple as any political ad may claim. So again, we urge you to think critically about what you hear in the spirit of promoting authentic and respectful civic dialogue.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. This is the Buzz of the North.
WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.